talking history. This is News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gahan. In tonight's show, we're exploring the life, legacy and legend of one of the great Victorian explorers, David Livingstone of Dr. Livingstone, I presume, fame. And we'll discover how he captured the imagination of his age. We'd love you to join our discussion. You can send us a text, 53106. Text costs 30 cents. Or you can email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week, we discussed Western perceptions of the Prophet Muhammad, the history of the dreadnoughts, what happened during World War I in the year 1917, and lots more besides in our January book show. And if you want to listen back to that or to any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. Tonight's debate is on David Livingstone. Born in a tenement in Scotland on the 19th of March, 1813, David Livingstone was sent to work as a child in the village mill, but continued with his studies after work. In 1840, he became a doctor, as well as being ordained a minister, and set off for Africa on missionary work, where he was a preacher, doctor, builder, and printer. Livingstone believed that the rivers and lakes were the highways for the spiritual and social regeneration of Africa, and so he became an explorer, discovering colossal waterfalls, which he named after Queen Victoria. Returning to Britain in 1856, he found himself a celebrity and published a book on his missionary work and travels. Considered a national hero, he returned to Africa in the years ahead on new expeditions. On his final journey to discover the source of the Nile, he was met by the journalist Stanley, who greeted him, or so it said, with the famous line of Dr. Livingstone, I presume. Livingstone died on the 30th of April, 1873. After his death, Livingstone was once more a national hero, viewed as an heroic explorer and a genial saint. In later years, his reputation was examined more objectively, and he was praised for his lack of religious or racial prejudice, but criticised for his lack of political sense, his tactlessness, and his deviousness. According to the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, Livingstone both embodied and transcended the 19th century tension between religion and science. And so in tonight's show, we want to explore his legacy. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Justin Livingstone lectures in the School of Arts, English and Languages at Queen's University Belfast. He's the author of Livingstone's Lives, a metabiography of a Victorian icon, and last year completed a digital project, Livingstone's Missionary Travels Manuscript, 1857, a critical edition, published by Livingstone Online. And I promise there'll be no Dr. Livingstone, I presume, jokes tonight, because I'm sure he is sick to death of them. Dr. John Luanda is a physician, social researcher, historian and writer, and his publications include groundbreaking articles on Livingstone. For example, Scotland, Malawi and Medicine, Livingstone's Legacy, I Presume, an Historical Perspective, and David Livingstone and Africa's First Cases of Sickle Cell Anemia. Professor Claire Pettit is Professor of 19th Century Literature and Culture at King's College London and is an expert on the Victorian era. And her books include Dr. Livingstone, I Presume, Missionaries, Journalists, Explorers and Empire. Well, you're all very welcome. And later in the show, I'll be talking to Professor Adrian Wisnicki, Faculty Fellow at the Centre for Digital Research at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and the Director of Livingstone Online, the major peer-reviewed digital humanities project, and Natalie Myler, curator of the David Livingstone Trust in Scotland. Well, as I say, you are all very welcome. And Justin, I might begin with you and a broad question about how big a Victorian icon David Livingstone was in the 19th century.
Yeah, he certainly was one of the most, I suppose, celebrated figures of the mid-Victorian period. He shot to fame in the 1850s through his celebrated transcontinental expedition across Africa. He was at least considered at the time to be the first European to have successfully traveled the whole breadth of the continent. And when reports of this reached Britain, he launched into the limelight. In fact, he was already beginning to develop a bit of a reputation in geography thanks to his earlier journey to Lake Ngami, his discovery of that. Gained him the medal, gold medal of the Royal Geographical Society. So Livingstone burst onto the stage at that point. And of course, he was also helped very much by his excellent death, can I put it like that, in 1873. What we might consider a kind of good death in Victorian terms. A death, heroic death, a death of martyrdom, a death doing mission work and exploration in Africa. So he really became an iconic figure and was celebrated as such widely in the mid-19th century, and then developed a reputation that continued well into at least the mid-20th century, if not beyond.
And it's interesting that his reputation has been examined more critically in the years since, but it hasn't been destroyed in the way that other reputations have. He still emerges as a remarkable figure, anti-slavery, someone who seems to have been free of prejudice. He certainly had his flaws, and they've been explored as well, but there was also great strengths and great aspects of the legacy which are still recognized.
Yeah, I think Livingstone has a very complicated legacy. What you'll find in at least the immediate, in the aftermath of Livingstone's death, is that he becomes this sort of patron saint, as John Mackenzie has described it, a kind of heroic figure of the British Empire. He develops this really powerful reputation, and he's then used in a lot of socio-political ways, I suppose, on behalf of empire then over the next several decades. He's held up as an icon of the scramble for Africa. He's used to sort of generate the momentum for the scramble for Africa. It seemed to give sort of moral entitlement. And so what you find with Livingstone's reputation is that he has this iconic status that with every kind of change or transformation, broadly speaking, in imperial policy up until the 1950s, Livingstone's reputation moves along with it. So in the 1920s, when League of Nations trusteeship becomes the new byword in imperial policy, well, biographers like R.J. Campbell discover that, well, of course, Livingstone was really the founder of trusteeship. When we go through into the period of, I suppose, beginning into imperial decline, we have partnership becoming this new discourse. And of course, Livingstone then becomes the founder of partnership. So Livingstone's legacy changes as an imperial icon along with changes in empire. But even today, as you pointed out, he continues to have a reputation. I think perhaps others in the panel might be able to speak to this more than I, but he continues to have a very complicated reputation, I think, even in Africa today, in somewhere like Zambia, where he can be continue to be held up and celebrated despite the kind of colonial legacy, the colonial connotations that his name had. So it is, of course, significant, isn't it, that the town Livingstone in Zambia continues to bear his name, as do Livingstonia and Blantyre in Malawi. And I think this points to the fact that despite Livingstone's imperial reputation, there was something about him that enabled him to be celebrated also by African peoples. Now, this is by no means unambiguous, but it certainly does point towards, I think, the complexity of his afterlife.
Very good. And John, I'll bring you in specifically on that. I wonder how Livingstone is viewed by Africans generally, but also specifically by Malawians and Zambians, and whether he's seen as a colonial figure or an imperial figure, or and as a negative icon, or indeed as a positive icon.
Well, it's a very complicated relationship and legacy. So let me start by a personal angle. I live less than a mile from where David Livingstone was born, and I'm speaking to you from, you know, that place. So without David Livingstone having gone to Malawi, maybe my life trajectory would have been different. But then now my view of Livingstone is different from when I was in Scotland first in the 70s, and experiencing, you know, all the racism of the, you know, his era. And there were days when I wished Livingstone hadn't gone to Malawi. But that's just a personal angle. Now, to go on to the broad thing about how Malawians and Zambians see Livingstone, it's extremely complicated. There's this term of something usable. So institutions, for example, missionaries and their successors, you know, the church leaders, they tend to use the name of Livingstone for their own ends. Governments tend to use the name of Livingstone for their own ends. If you look at what Livingstone did as a person, he went there as somebody of the era. Now, I do not think that Livingstone could have removed himself from that era. He was a European of that particular period. And within that period, there might be a few criticisms of his personal behavior. But, you know, anybody can criticize anybody's personal behavior. But he had this principle that he went there because he wanted Christianity, commerce, and civilization to come to Africa. So if we take then Christianity, Zambia and Malawi, Zimbabwe, South Africa, you know, most of Southern Africa, is overblessed with Christianity. You know, problems are not solved. You know, let's have a problem or let's pray about it. We have this electricity blackouts, let's pray about them. So it's become a joke. You have commerce. Commerce is not succeeding. You know, we have all these countries which are very fertile, you know, Zimbabwe, Malawi, Zambia. Where are we going to? It's not being addressed. Governments are not doing what Livingstone hoped would be done. Civilization, you know, that speaks to education, civics and good governance. And so on. So, from all these, you know, various points of view, his philosophy or whatever he hoped would result from his trips to Africa has been partially realized, but not entirely. And it is unfair to blame him for the failure of those things to be fulfilled. I hope you get what I'm trying to say.
I do indeed, John. Thank you so much for that. And Claire, I'd like to bring you in as well on an interesting aspect of the legend of Livingstone, because most explorers are famous for what they discover, but he's in a way more remembered for being discovered. And there's such a mythology around the Stanley discovery and the famous line, and I've read something saying, did he say, and was it prescripted, and how this mythologized him. But that Dr. Livingstone, I presume, would be the one thing that almost everyone out there would know about Livingstone, even if they know nothing else about his life and career.
I think that's absolutely right. And in fact, yeah, I've written a whole book about that. So I do agree with you. I think that actually, certainly in my own youth, my own childhood, the way I encountered Livingstone first was through that phrase, which I think I first read on a lollipop stick. You know, you used to get things written on your ice lolly stick. So it was already an iconic phrase. And it took me probably 2 years of research, actually, to work out really why we still remember that phrase and what we've forgotten around it. Because I think what's very important, particularly in imperial history, really, is what we forget and what we choose to remember. And listening to your previous two speakers, like we've already been told some of the things that we've forgotten, which I think is fantastic. The complexity of modernity in Africa at the time, in the 1860s and 70s, when Livingstone was there. And the idea that actually this is not Stanley finding Livingstone in the middle of a kind of wilderness. It's actually Livingstone is actually being looked after very generously and supported by Arab Africans and Black Africans in actually quite a developed township is where he's actually discovered. So I think, you know, we tend to think of it as this discovery of Stanley finds Livingstone in some sort of jungle clearing. That's not what happened at all. And if you start looking quite literally, actually, at the picture more carefully, you begin to see that there are houses in the background. This is a civilized place. That actually, this is a culture which Livingstone himself knows very well. He is entirely dependent on. So the whole idea that the American explorer Stanley discovers this man, this British explorer, and saves him is not really right at all.
And do you think it's the genius of this short soundbite sentence that helps with that international message that it suddenly becomes famous? Or is there something about the romance of the story that it is mythologized? What is it about it that is it that this is 140 characters or less, and that in a 19th century world it goes viral?
It's a tweet. I think it's actually a bit more sinister than that, to be honest. I mean, of course, you know, this is a phrase which comes up in The Muppet Show and Star Trek, and it's hugely ubiquitous these days, this Dr. Livingston, I presume. But I actually think there's a problem with this, in that I think the comedy of it at the time, when it was first reported in 1872, was around the idea that you would bother being so polite to somebody in Africa. So I think people found it amusing because they thought, why would you stick to such sort of etiquette in the midst of such a barbaric place? Actually, of course, what that tells us is that that's an extraordinarily racist idea. And that actually Livingston, who himself, I think, would say that he was living in a very civilized place. There was a huge etiquette around how you approach somebody in that village and how you address them. And actually, Stanley was not ridiculous for being formal and polite in the situation in which he found himself. But it very quickly became a kind of music hall joke that you would ever bother being polite in Africa, because, you know, why would you bother being polite in Africa? It's so uncivilized.
Okay, so a much darker element to that line.
I think so, yeah.
Justin, it's interesting that I've read that Charles Dickens admired David Livingstone's book about his travel experiences. And there is something Dickensian about the story of Livingstone, even the difficult childhood growing up in a tenement, studying late at night after coming home from a day working in the mill. There is something heroic in his rise.
Yes, I think that's right. He certainly fulfilled for the Victorians many of the tropes of self-help, sort of Samuel Smiles' version of self-help in the period. He, in Scottish terms as well, was what we might call, you know, a lad of parts who worked in the mill 10 hours a day or up to 12, educated himself at night. He went to school for 2 hours in the evening, and then he obviously went on to study medicine in Anderson's College. So he's very much a kind of embodiment of those Victorian values of self-help, which I think is, certainly to be admired. Livingston was an autodidact. He did rise from working class roots in the Central Belt in Scotland. Yet we have to recognise at the same time that this is what this sort of fed into the mythology of Livingston, that he was this individual who rose against the odds. And I think this becomes very much an important part of his reputation in the Victorian period. It's why it feeds into his myth. The biographers are able to pick up on this feature of his life. So yes, indeed, Livingston is almost heroic in his rise from those working class roots in industrial Scotland. But it's also a key part of that sort of mythic trajectory that's so important to Livingston's later reputation. I think it's worth pointing out, actually, just when you mention Livingston's early life in Blantyre, it's romanticized a lot in a kind of Dickensian mood, isn't it? But actually, Livingston was working in extremely difficult conditions. He was always known as a piecer in the Blantyre mill. That means he was repairing threads on spinning jennies. It was very physical work. The Blantyre mill, run by Monteith Bogle and Company, had among the longest and most longest hours and most arduous conditions of any mill in Scotland. Stephen Mullen, an historian, has pointed out that it had a higher proportion of child workers. It was more reliant on a child labour force than many other mills in the area, in Glasgow and the Greater Glasgow area. At the same time, it must be acknowledged that the mill owners did provide a school. They did support a Scottish, a Church of Scotland minister. But it's tempting to sort of romanticise Livingston's background in industrial Scotland, but actually it was an incredibly difficult start.
And Justin, how did an ordained minister and missionary become a great celebrated explorer? What drove him to do these huge expeditions across Africa?
Yeah, so Livingstone started off really as a conventional missionary. Funnily enough, he later would describe conventional missionary work as a sort of dumpy man with a Bible under his arm. So he came to characterize conventional missionaries in not such a favorable way. But that's very much what he started out doing. So he spent his first 11 years in Southern Africa from 1841 to 1852, very much as that sort of conventional missionary. He had three stations across those 11 years, mostly working with the Botswana under the leadership of Seychelles. Seychelles was an individual who would become one of the major figures of Christianization in present-day Botswana and Southern Africa more generally. Livingstone spent time across these three stations, but he increasingly became captivated by a vision of extending the missionary enterprise into Central Africa by pioneering what he called a transcontinental highway into the interior. So he had this optimistic vision of a highway from the coast into the center of the continent that would facilitate contact with the European world. So in 1849, Livingstone, he'd heard about a lake in the interior, as he put it, and he tried to reach it. This was Lake Ngami. At around that time, he also heard of a people group, the Makalulu, which was really a Central African empire under the leadership of an individual called Sebatwana. And Livingstone wanted to reach this individual. And in doing so, he learned about a river, and that river was the Zambezi River. And he became captivated by reaching this river, and he hoped that this would prove to be that transcontinental highway, and that highway across the continent that he optimistically and perhaps naively hoped would open Central Africa to European influence. So it was at that point that Livingstone undergoes this shift in the early 1850s from conventional missionary work to exploration, though it should be said that he always considered there to be an integral connection between his geographical work and his missionary efforts. He put it something like this, that the beginning of the geographical enterprise was just the beginning of the missionary endeavor. So he always saw them as connected, but that was the vision, I think, that motivated that transformation from conventional missionary work in mission stations in Southern Africa to that effort to cross the continent, that effort to find that transcontinental highway into the interior.
And Claire, it's interesting, it wasn't a one-man operation, that he relied very heavily on the Africans that he had working with him and the people who essentially kept him alive on these expeditions.
Absolutely, yes. And of course, there's a whole other story there. There's a kind of flip side story of those Africans about whom we know lamentably little, because of course there are very little written records of how they felt about everything they were doing. But Livingstone did keep his servants, and he would insist, of course, upon calling them servants, because they very much weren't slaves. He did keep his servants for quite long periods of time, which was unusual in those days. So I mean, we might be able to draw from that perhaps he was actually quite a sort of decent employer. He kept some servants right to the end of his life, and in fact some of those servants returned. Jacob Wainwright, one of them, came over on the boat with Livingstone's coffin back to England, and then two more of his servants, Susie and Schumer, who in fact have been much longer in his employ, were sent over after that to help compiling Livingstone's memoirs by Horace Waller. So three of his African servants actually did come to England, and I was quite interested when I was researching my book to think about how that must have felt for them, because in fact these men are also explorers, these men are also geographers. They had a remarkable, in fact it was remarked upon by Horace Waller how great their geographical knowledge was, Susie and Schumer, but you know, they're not remembered in the same way as explorers and geographers. But they came to England and toured England, Scotland, and presumably had their own thoughts about this foreign country that they were exploring. Unfortunately, they didn't record them the way that Livingstone recorded his ideas about Africa.
And I suppose we should also mention his wife. I didn't mention her in the introduction, but she travelled with him and died then, I think, after having six children.
Yes, yes. That's right. She travelled with him initially, then she went back to England when the family was increasing to the point where it was felt that she would be safer back in Scotland. In fact, I think she had a fairly dreadful time in Scotland because, you know, Livingston never really made very much money. And she was on very, very, short rations, really, back in Scotland with an increasing family. She did then go out and rejoin him, and that was a rather sad story, I think, where the reports are that she was extremely unhappy, and that she was possibly drinking too much, and she died in Africa and was buried in Africa. It's impossible always, isn't it, to think about what other people's marriages or relationships were like. It seems to me, reading everything that I've read, that this was not a loveless relationship, but that actually Livingston was a bit of a monomaniac, and I don't think he put his family first very much, so I think it was pretty tough being Mrs. Livingston. It was more fun being the hero, I think.
And he regretted in later years that he hadn't spent enough time with his children.
He did indeed, yes. I think that if you look at the children's reactions to their father, you can sense that there's a certain feeling of abandonment around, I think. I mean, he just wasn't there for most of their lives, really.
John, it's very interesting when you look at his exploration, because he's credited with discovering things like the Victoria Falls, but of course he's discovering things for a European audience that Africans would have been very much aware of. And there is that tension between his vision of Christianity, commerce and civilization and the people that he's encountering along the way.
Well, I don't think it's his fault. Maybe it is. I don't know. It was the period. If a European went out to discover something, but if an African came to England, they merely came to England. I think that was just the balance of power in those days. So, for example, you were talking earlier about Susi Nchuma and all the other Africans who accompanied him. These were not timid Africans. For example, he took the Makololo from Botswana, and they came to Malawi. And no sooner had Livingstone departed, the Makololo overcame all the local chiefs in whose care Livingstone had left them, and they established what is now the Makololo chieftains. You know, they were not timid, you know, Africans, but the written records were European. So as they say, we read about the history of the people who wrote the history, not the ones who spoke about it. On the point of his wife, very little again is talked about his wife in Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Malawi, where I'm familiar with, because we've got this gender problem. It's always a man's history. So we remember Livingston. Mrs. Livingston is forgotten. I have actually, interestingly, not read anything or seen anybody doing a research paper on Mary Livingston or the gender aspect of Livingston's story. That's a good point. I must ask one of my history lectures who does gender studies. But coming back to Livingstone himself, he went there as a conventional missionary. We are told that he apparently only succeeded in converting one person, and then he had this vision that, well, what I'm doing really is not for me, or maybe if I broaden my canvas a bit, I might achieve more. And then obviously he turned to exploring and trying to preserve whatever lands he was moving in for the United Kingdom. In the case of Malawi, of course, he didn't succeed because we let the Portuguese and the Cecil Rhodes take large chunks of Malawi, leaving us with a thin strip of land.
Yeah, it is remarkable. I'd come across that as well, that in his missionary work succeeded in converting one person, but then went off and had this more ambitious, dramatic vision for the contribution he could make through these explorations. Okay, we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, I'll be talking to Professor Adrian Wisnicki about the Livingston Online Project and the insight we can get from studying Livingston's manuscripts and journals.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we explore the life and legacy of David Livingstone. And I'm delighted to be joined on the phone now, joining us live from an airport in Seattle, where he's coming back from a conference, Professor Adrian Wisnicki, faculty fellow at the Center for Digital Research at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and an expert on Victorian literature and culture. And he's the director of Livingstone Online, a major peer-reviewed digital humanities project, and of a related project, the Livingstone Spectral Imaging Project. And he's produced critical editions of Livingstone's manuscripts and works, and his new book is Fieldwork of Empire, 1840 to 1900. Adrian, you're very welcome, and thanks for joining us tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
Can we begin by just can you just let our listeners know what the Livingstone Online Project is?
So Livingstone Online is a digital humanities project that's been running for about 15 years or so. And digital humanities, the short version, means the application of computers, technology, and other kinds of media like that to the study of traditional humanities disciplines. So in the case of our project, we do two things. One, we're interested in studying the total manuscript and visual legacy of David Livingstone. And we work as an archival project where we collect digital images of various items related to Livingstone and then publish them on the site. And then the second thing that we do is we apply advanced imaging technology to a selection of Livingstone's manuscripts in an effort to get more information than is available with the naked eye from those manuscripts.
And talk to us about some of the critical editions you've produced, because you've looked at Livingstone's manuscripts and his works. And what insight have you gained from that?
Sure. So that's a good question. So over the last couple of years, we've run a number of projects concurrently, and those have in general taken the form of critical editions, which means that we select some portion of Livingstone's text that have a kind of overall coherence, and then develop very good reading texts of those materials, plus add various kinds of critical materials to those texts. And so we've worked with manuscripts related to David Livingstone's last journey, related to his first published book, Missionary Travels, related to the various collections that are in South Africa. And then we've also had two editions that have been related to our work with spectral imaging. And, you know, as that kind of very quick overview suggests, it covers a lot of different portions of Livingstone's career. And so overall, we've had a lot of different kinds of insights into Livingstone, and I'd be happy to talk about those.
And I also have to ask you about the spectral imaging. What extra insight does that give you?
Sure. So the way spectral imaging works, just to kind of unpack it very quickly, is it takes any given object, so in our case, it's manuscript pages, and illuminates it with different wavelengths of light. So one wavelength at a time. So for example, a band of green, a band of blue. As you move through the visible and invisible spectra in that way, different elements of the manuscript are revealed. So there are things that you might see only in the blue spectrum, or you might only see in the infrared. And those become, once we have kind of the raw data and that's processed by scientists, we're able to see things that you might not otherwise see. So that's how spectral imaging works.
And so what does this reveal, or what does this uncover?
So we've used spectral imaging in two ways. One, we've used it to uncover writing that was literally not visible. So we worked on one of Livingstone's diaries from 1871, where the text had faded over time to the point of not being visible at all. And so we were able to take a whole diary, which I believe was about 60 pages or so, and go from about 15 to 20% legibility to almost 98, 99% legibility. Once we were able to see the text, we were able to get details about this period of Livingstone's career, and to learn about his involvement with the Central African slave trade in more detail than we had been able to before.
Very good. And it's interesting, we've talked about how in the 19th century his image was that of, he was a Victorian icon and he was almost seen as a saint, but in more recent times, as more information has become available, it's a much more complex image. But one of the great parts of that legacy is that opposition to slavery and his strong views there.
Correct. So what we've really been able to do through the Spectral Imaging Project and through Livingston Online as a whole is to develop a much more complex and nuanced understanding of Livingston, his place in the 19th century, in terms of the British Empire, but also in terms of local African history in the regions he's visited. And so we've been able to see him in the different kinds of relationships that he had in order to sustain his career. And that's brought out different facets of kind of his interactions with various scientists, various politicians of the day, but also his interactions with and dependence on local populations in Africa. And that's a part of that latter point is a part of the historical record that hasn't really come to light previously in the way that it has through our project.
And in terms of your new book on fieldwork of empire, could these expeditions be considered part of that?
Yes, that's correct. So my new book, Fieldwork of Empire, which has just come out this year from Routledge, takes a look at a variety of explorers. So David Livingston, but also people like Richard Burton, John Hanning Speke, Samuel White Baker, Henry Morton Stanley. A lot of the kind of celebrity explorers of the 19th century who visited Africa. And thinks about the original manuscripts of those explorers rather than their published books. The original manuscripts often have information that was left out or edited out of the published books. And then thinks about what that original information reveals about how these explorers operated in local African contexts. And one of the big points that's come out of that book that's really extending work that we've also done through Livingston Online is that scholars as a whole have in general underestimated the wide reliance that explorers like David Livingston and others had on local populations. And in some ways, they were traveling, they were seeing things firsthand, but a lot of the information that they collected was not gathered through firsthand observation, but through interactions with local populations, through interviews with local populations, through the kind of collecting and integrating of data gathered from those local populations. And so that's gotten us to think about the 19th century historical record in a very different kind of way. And when I say that, what I mean is multi-author, right? We're used to thinking of something like a David Livingston book or a manuscript as a single author text. We now are much more moving towards a model where we think of these texts as collaborative texts, where Livingston is almost like the amanuensis. There are lots of people contributing information. It's just that Livingston has the final say. And even that point is kind of complicated.
Excellent. Okay, well, Adrian, we don't want you to miss your flight, so we'll leave it there. Professor Adrian Wisnicki, who is an expert on Victorian literature and culture and the director of the brilliant Livingston Online. We are going to leave Adrian there, but we'll be right back after this, where we'll continue our discussion with the panel on the life, legacy and legend of David Livingston.
Is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the life, legacy and legend of David Livingston. I'm joined by Dr. Justin Livingston, Dr. John Luanda, Professor Claire Pettit, and we are also joined now for the final part of the show by Natalie Myler, who's the creator of the David Livingston Trust, based at his birthplace, and it's where people can learn about and be inspired by Livingston's life and legacy. Claire, can we talk a little bit more about the famous encounter between Stanley and Livingston in 1871, because is it true that that Livingston had been missing for a number of years, or that there hadn't been any contact between him and the outside world? Was there a sense that Stanley was sent on a mission to try and discover him because people were curious and concerned?
That's a really good question. It seems to me that yes, there had not been any contact from Livingston for some time, but I don't think that this was it was not particularly in the public mind. I think it was Stanley actually that decided to put this into the public mind. And the whole story that Stanley tells, who's another very interesting character, of course, in Livingston's story, Stanley's story is that he's called into the office by Gordon Bennett, the editor of the New York Herald, which is like one of the probably the first modern tabloid newspaper in New York. and is told to go and in his memoirs, he puts this in capital letters, find Livingstone. Well, actually, it's probably unlikely that that happened, because in fact, what happened was that Stanley got sent on a big journalistic tour. He had to go and report on ruins in Egypt and do a sort of a tour of the Middle East before he even got to Africa. And it seems likely that Stanley decided to go and find Livingstone on his own initiative, partly because he was busy building his own journalistic career and he wanted a scoop. And he could see that if he could find Livingstone, who had gone missing, as it were, hadn't been in touch for a long time, that would be a sort of career-making story for him as a journalist. And indeed, so it turned out to be.
And so it turns out to be. And again, this has become so famous and memorialized, and Spencer Tracy played Stanley in a famous movie. And it's not clear whether it was significant necessarily, this meeting, but it certainly captured the imagination of the world.
It certainly did. It's interesting you mentioned the movie, actually, because that takes a very American view of the entire thing and is very much on Stanley's sort of side, as it were, rather than Livingstone's, or is much more interested in Stanley than it is in Livingstone. And I think at the time in the 1870s, Stanley was a really important part of this story. It connected to all kinds of anxieties in the 1870s about the Anglo-American relationship, because, of course, this was just after the end of the American Civil War. Britain had not behaved particularly well during the Civil War, in fact, and the victorious North, the Union troops, the Union side, were pretty cross that the British government had allowed Confederate warships to be built in British shipyards and so on. So Britain and America had fallen out quite badly. America was asking Britain to pay in compensation what was called the Alabama Treaty was drawn up, where Britain was going to have to compensate America for what it had done during the Civil War. So actually, in many ways, this was very useful, because the idea of an American shaking a British man's hand and that idea of Anglo-Saxon brotherhood played very, very well at a time when tensions were running very high between America and England. And I think it did quite a lot of useful political work in the sense at that moment.
Justin, in terms of the opposition to slavery, how significant was that in terms of his career?
Yeah, I think that's very much an important part of Livingstone's career as a motivating impulse for him. He had this vision of introducing legitimate commerce, as he put it, into Central Africa, in the hope that it would undermine slavery. This was a vision derived from Thomas Buxton, and earlier thinkers, and it's the idea was that by creating markets for European products and using African raw materials, that this would then create an industry, or create a system of trade that would therefore undermine reliance on slavery. So, of course, subsequent scholars have criticized this as a naive vision. It doesn't take account of the ways in which legitimate commerce might actually perpetuate the demand for slavery in East and Central Africa. But nevertheless, slavery was a major part of Livingstone's inspiration, really. That was something that motivated him to a great extent. And of course, it's very important to Livingstone's later celebrity and fame as well. Shortly before meeting Stanley, which Claire has already talked about, in 1871, Livingstone found himself in a village called Nyangwe on the Lualaba River. And he was at this point unable to go forward. He was unable to access canoes to travel in the next portion of the river. And at this point, he witnessed a massacre perpetrated by a trading caravan, where in the vicinity of 400 people were killed at the local Manyema market in Nyangwe. At this point in his travels, Livingstone had actually been very reliant on Arab Zanzibari traders. He'd been at a Luweb and short in supplies, and so had relied on them for safe passage across considerable portions of Central Africa. But at this point, he sees this massacre committed by slavers, and it's an incredibly traumatic experience for Livingstone, and leads him to, at this point, turn back towards the trading center on Lake Tanganyika, Ujiji, which is where he then meets Stanley. And he writes at this point, a record of that experience of seeing this slaughter at the market that Stanley is then able to transport to the outside world. So one of the things that's so useful for Livingstone about Stanley is that Stanley can bring him news from Europe. Livingstone had, as Claire's already said, been roughly without contact from the European world for about a year, and John Kirk, consul of Zanzibar, had been unsuccessful in sending Livingstone supplies. So Stanley's able to allow Livingstone to disseminate this report of slavery back home. And when it does return home, it really gives considerable momentum to the almost late Victorian at this point, the late Victorian abolitionist movement, and figures whom Clare's or figures like Horace Waller, whom Clare has already mentioned, then use this report by Livingstone of the state of slavery in Central Africa to popularise their humanitarian cause.
Excellent. Natalie, I want to talk to you about the David Livingstone Trust. Can you tell us about its work and also about what people can see when they visit the birthplace?
So the David Livingstone Trust was set up in 1929, and that's when the museum opened. And the idea behind it was that they wanted to have a place that would memorialise David Livingstone and have a place that could be sort of serve as a repository for legacy objects. So we've got about 5,000 objects in our collection, which are held in the museum. And at the moment, we're undergoing a refurbishment, so we've been given money from the National Lottery Heritage Fund, Historic Environment Scotland and the Scottish Government to undergo this massive refurbishment. And the museum itself is going to be about a third larger than it is at the moment, and we are very much kind of following the chronological route of Livingstone's life, starting, you know, with the bathroom, essentially, and kind of going all the way to the point where, you know, he's died and being buried in Westminster.
And do you find the people who come to the birthplace are inspired by the story of David Livingstone? What are the aspects that encourage them to go and see the spot?
Well, I mean, a lot of people do see it as a bit of a site of pilgrimage. People do get very emotional, and the fact that you can go into this tiny single-ended tenement and see where David Livingstone was born, when people have learned so much about him throughout their lives in school and, you know, in all the activities that they're doing. And people do get very moved by this tiny space and kind of being able to see the objects that are so closely affiliated with his life.
Very good. Now, Claire, we're almost out of time, but in terms of the legacy of Livingstone, what would you sum it up as?
Oh, that's difficult. I personally, it's very personal, I'm still impressed by the fact that Livingstone understood that there was culture in Africa. He understood that Africa had its own version of modernity. He understood, for instance, that polygamy was not a sort of sexual practice. It was actually a cultural, political practice. He was actually, and, you know, as others have said, given that we have to judge him by the standards of his day, he was extraordinary, I think, actually, in understanding, and probably because he was there for so long, understanding that Africa was a very complex and very modern place that he needed to work hard to understand.
Very good. And we got a text in from one of our regular listeners, Elizabeth and Rahini, who wants to know if it's true that Livingstone's heart is still in Africa.
Yes, that is true. It's buried in the biscuit tin under a tree in the village of Ilala, where he died, because, in fact, his servants eviscerated him and dried out his body so that they could transport it the 1,000 or so miles to the coast.
Very good. Okay, well, we'll leave the final word to John Luanda. John, in terms of Livingstone in the history of Africa, how significant a figure is he?
Oh, very significant. For us, it is the free, his contributions towards the freeing of the slaves. Just in passing, when I did our paper on sickle cell, it is the detail of his diaries that was very, very, you know, a lot of us have done PhDs and we go and field notes, but his notes were very detailed, and of course, a lot of Malawians who come to visit us in Scotland, number one, they want to go and see the David Livingstone Centre. So really, he's still very, very iconic as far as Malawians, Zambians are concerned.
Very good. good. Okay, well, that's a perfect note in which to end our discussion. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Justin Livingston, Dr. John Lawanza, Professor Claire Pettit, Professor Adrian Wisnicki, and Natalie Myler. That does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cahill, my producer, and David Nolan on sound. Next week, we're looking at the Battle of Singapore, and we'll be finding out why Winston Churchill considered it the worst disaster and the largest capitulation in British military history, and why Hitler considered it a setback for the white race. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.